This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. Beginning in the early 1980s, Iraq's Ministry of Information and Culture began educating selected men as simultaneous interpreters. Only a handful of men did this in English for the inner circle around Saddam Hussein and his top government officials. One who did was Esho Joseph. He once called himself Esho Yusuf. Despite his status, he led a secret life of abuse and harassment. When NPR's Jackie Lydon met him in Baghdad in 1991, he was on the verge of defecting.
Having such a bitter life, I'm planning to leave for good. But to where, I don't know. I'm given a questionnaire almost every week to know all details about me. So I think I am in trouble.
Since 1992, he's lived in the United States. He teaches Arabic at the Defense Language Institute in California. Joseph had always hoped to return to an Iraq free of Saddam Hussein, and in November of last year, he did. Jackie Lydon accompanied him on his journey back.
In August of 1991, in the dead of night, Esho Joseph took his wife and, in an act of desperation, drove over the border to defect, leaving behind family, colleagues, country, everything. There was no return. He was under suspicion, he was Christian, and he felt marked for execution. But what bothered him most after 9 years of translating for the regime, as he recalls it, was that he could no longer abide having Saddam Hussein's words in his mouth.
Listen, you know yourself, and now you are just like these hypocrites, these fucks that are serving Saddam, and like I'm contributing. I'm like a criminal. No way. This is not me. I am suffering. I cannot just continue with this type of suffering, having this sense of guilt every moment. I couldn't sleep. I was really torn up every single moment.
Twelve years later, on November 13, 2003, he waits to cross back into Iraq the same way he'd left it, at the Jordanian border. He sits in the white GMC truck that looks like a lighted ship plowing a dark sea, and marvels that he can drive into Iraq as a free man.
It's 3:30 in the morning. We will be in Iraq in about an hour. Hundreds of thoughts and ideas and memories are racing through my mind right now. Once I saw the sign saying "Welcome to Free Iraq," it really, don't know, is it a feeling of joy? I'm believing, I don't know how to explain it. In entering Iraq without seeing the big poster of Saddam, it's just unbelievable to me. This was a dream. Seeing Iraq without Saddam Hussein, that by itself is the greatest achievement that I can dream of.
There must be somewhere here. This is the building of the National Assembly. I used to come frequently to do the translation for the speaker.
Arriving in Baghdad, it both is and isn't the city of memory. He was 40 when he left. He's 52 now. The bridges, Jadriya, Jamhuriya, Shuhada, span the brown Tigris River as they did before. The thousands of palm trees line boulevards and riverfronts. But it's also a city of ruin. Many old sites, such as his workplace and other government buildings, have been bombed and looted, and the traffic is horrific.
The number of cars is unbelievable. So many cars, and the pollution,
Until a few weeks earlier, he'd not allowed himself to speak to his older sister on the telephone in all this time. He's not sure how she'll receive him today. Pulling up to the house, There's his brother-in-law, Munir, and right behind comes his sister, Hane, now 60 and overjoyed.
This is my sister, Hane. Oh, Munir.
Oh, Bob, you know.
Khati, that's good. Oh, can we stop?
Hane looks careworn. Her legs bother her. Her eyes, large and blue, are vaguely troubled, like her brother's.
I thought I would die and not see him again.
Her son is in Germany. Two other brothers and a sister have each scattered to different countries around the world. Australia, Sweden, France.
You know, it's the hardest thing, not to see your brothers anymore. We used to see each other frequently, almost every day. Then all of a sudden, they disappear. You know, I cannot believe it was just like I lost him, and now I found him. Is it a true thing or is it a dream? I'm very happy. I feel like I own the entire world.
Amid this happiness, though, there is this to consider. They stayed, Isha left. And because he left, Hane's husband Munir lost his job as chauffeur to Tariq Aziz, then Saddam Hussein's foreign minister. The family also lost a government apartment. Munir was called in and for months repeatedly interrogated about his brother-in-law, Isha.
I was not mad at him because it was his life. He's just like my brother and I wanted him to be happy. We have this feeling in our culture that we are ready to sacrifice for the sake of others. So for us, it was fine as long as he was safe. That was the main thing.
Over coffee and sweets, Isha gazes at his family, determined to find that post-war Iraq is a positive place.
Back in the United States, what kind of image and impression we have that this country is in a chaos, disorder, and everything is miserable, and things are really very grim and bad. And now I don't think it's that bad. I mean, take this family. Isn't it hopeful that things will get better?
The next day is spent looking for colleagues. It's clear that an exile's memory is selective. Instead of cursing the nightmarish traffic jams, Isha concentrates on the flags flying for the once banned Communist Party, or marvels at the formerly outlawed Shiite religious texts now on offer in the book market. But in trying to make his next move to find his old coterie of government translators, he's stymied. The Ministry of Information is only a shell.
I wish I could get into the building. It's sealed off. No access to the building.
Maybe, he thinks, he could get some leads where he had his second job, as features editor at the English-language Baghdad Observer newspaper. But it, too, is ravaged and empty, and squatters let us in. This building is a five-story litter bin of the past, laden with crumpled photographs of Saddam and his regime cascading down the stairwells. And because the windows are all missing, traffic blares even to the top floors.
I have very bitter memory in this specific room.
In 1987, Isho Joseph tried to defect in London on a government trip, deliberately missing a scheduled flight back to Baghdad. As he agonized over the consequences to his family, Iraqi intelligence detained him and forcibly returned him to the country in handcuffs. Years of abuse then began in this very office.
Someone from intelligence came in and he began yelling and shouting. He took off his gun and he put it on my forehead. And he said, "I can now shoot you. You are nothing but an insect that can crush you under my shoes." And he said, "One day you'll see you'll get crushed by a vehicle." Yeah. He said every thought he was my mom, my sisters. And I couldn't even open my mouth. Just like a stone.
ordering that abuse and tortures be kept secret was Saddam Hussein's invisible lock and key on millions of Iraqis.
I hate myself telling this story to anyone. None of my family knew about what happened to me that day. Anyone didn't know. I went back home. I smiled as usual. If they didn't know what was going on deep in my heart.
It all culminated on the night of February 8th, 1988. There was a knock at the door. Isha was bundled first into a waiting car, tied, and dumped into a swimming pool in the Al Misbah neighborhood.
I think it was him.
I was blindfolded. My hands were tied to my back. I remember I stumbled. You know, when I fell, then they pulled me and pushed me into the pool.
He remained in the freezing, foul water all night, thinking he would die like his grandfather, who'd been tortured by the Turks in front of Isho's father in 1915. In the morning, he was hauled out and ordered to return to his job.
I told myself, I must be brave enough. I must go to work and never show to my colleagues that I had any problem, even though some of them could see that I did not sleep. I looked very pale. I remember one of my colleagues said, why don't you go home and take some time off? And I told him, no, I'm fine. My mom was really not feeling well last night. I took her to hospital and, you know, I really lied, you know.
Isho's colleagues suspected he was in trouble, and as he continues to look for them, he finds his old supervisor, Sadoun al-Janabi, who supervised all the translators. He's a Sunni Muslim, translating now for American media and headquartered at a small hotel. They embrace in the hallway.
Shona,
hello.
Shona.
It's nice to have you back.
Shona.
We have grown old, gray hair. Old memories have gone.
Remembering the past and reminiscing about the old days of translating, the question is raised if these men, who did, after all, go to work for the regime, weren't at least somewhat complicit in their fate.
We had an oath we call the oath of a translator, is to be a machine. You have encoding information, outgoing information, and that's it. A duty, you cannot judge people by duties. I must remind you, you know, even the translator of Hitler, he's also a human being and he has feelings. Perhaps he's not pro-Nazi, but he was forced to do interpretation and translation to Hitler with all the other statesmen of the world.
Isho admits that even then he was proud of being a linguist.
Of course, it's not a badge of honor. Obviously, we felt offended consciously because it was appalling for us. It was horrible sometimes to interpret statements like those. But would we have option? Couldn't we refrain from translating any statement of his? No way. That would have cost our life.
What redeemed their lives, amid the fears and threats, was their concern on each other's behalf, the exchanges of books, records, and kindnesses. By going back to his old friends in Baghdad, Isho had managed to visit the people who he could previously only see, as he says, in his dreams.
We're heading towards the site of an explosion that went off just maybe 15 to 20 minutes ago.
If there's one place that Isho Joseph thinks there will be more stability, it's in the north. He wants to travel to his home region near the Turkish border and stop along the way at the places where he translated for the regime. He's convinced that security will improve the further we get from the capital, But at Kirkuk, our first stop, there's immediate trouble. A car bomb has just gone off on the next block, killing four people. Windows have blown out at the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Isha is inside, hearing victim stories.
I heard explosion and I saw the blood bleeding from my face.
The Toyota, white colors, Toyota. Yes.
I see the bodies on the street. Very dangerous, young.
Revenge, shouts a gunman in the hallway. On whom would you take the revenge, yells a man, restraining him. Isha finds his confidence about Iraq's future beginning to fade.
I'm stunned and shocked. Minutes before the explosion, I was saying that I was impressed by how things were handled and how quiet this city was. I hope that would not create a kind of pointing a finger of accusation to some ethnic groups, you know, it's a sign to make us come to conclusion that there is no safe place in this, in this country, I would say.
Maybe things will be better where he has the most childhood memories, in Zarqa, his hometown. Approaching it, pastoral plains of wheat rise toward the mountains in the distance. A 4th-century stone bridge spans the Zarqa River, a tributary of the Tigris. Here is a moment of pure joy. Isho can hardly contain himself, and he sings a song the villagers have sung for generations, telling the story of the mythic bridge builder.
Have nice, beautiful memories in this area. Yeah. It's childhood.
But as he drives around, he realizes how much has changed. Since his last visit here 12 years ago, his remaining relatives have died. He doesn't know who's gone, who stayed, which way the street traffic runs now. Strangers have to point the way to his old neighborhood. A boy tells him of an acquaintance who's gone to Baghdad and shows him the way to his former church. The Church of St. George stands on a hill in the old quarter. From inside its thick stucco walls comes the sound of young people praying in his native language, Assyrian Chaldean. A disappearing ancient language from the Aramaic spoken in biblical times. He finally meets someone who does recognize him. Father Paulus, his old deacon. He remembers Isho as a good student and is glad to see him.
Of course I remember you and all your relatives. You are not only from this community, you are one of us.
Father Paulus tells Isho the painful facts of dwindling Christian presence here. Only 500 Christian families remain in this community of 70,000 Muslims, a vestigial remnant since Isho's youth.
None of the local people of Zaho who became exiles have come back and met with us. You are the first.
He's eager to have Isho meet the young people and introduces him as a parishioner returned from America. Then the priest leads the teenagers in a hymn in Chaldean. It's a culmination of a long journey in which home is mostly a memory, and his fears of even this small presence of his old life vanishing are realized. When the hymn is finished, Isho breaks down.
I grew up this way, having these beautiful songs, reciting verses from the Holy Bible, and enjoying a beautiful life. But that was a short-lived period of my life. It was killed. My hope is that this will continue on this land, Father's land. Yes, Mesopotamia. These young boys and girls are so hopeful for having a better future on this land. My hope is that they would stay, would not do what I did to leave this place. God bless them. Live in peace. That's my hope.
For 12 years, Isho Joseph waited for the chance to return to Iraq as a free man. Stopping by his mother's windblown grave in a Baghdad cemetery, he fulfilled a vow he'd made when he left to confront the demons who gave him what he called then a bitter life. Life is sweeter in the United States, but his children won't grow up speaking his native language, Chaldean. And because of the family's scattering, none of the next generation will grow up speaking a common language at all. The cost of Isho Joseph's freedom was the loss of his culture. His most ardent hope is that his former countrymen won't have to make that choice. I'm Jackie Lydon for NPR News.
You can see pictures of Isho's return to Iraq and hear more about his life under Saddam's regime at our website, npr.org.